Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
I'm actor, director, writer, and sometimes DJ Diallo Riddle.
And I'm producer, DJ, and sometimes guy on TikTok who whispers interpolation, luxury. And this is One Song. The show where we deconstruct and celebrate some of your favorite songs from the past 60 years in music history and tell you why they deserve one more listen. We promise you'll never hear these songs the same way again. Diallo, how have you been?
I've been good. I've been going back and listening to Chucky Booker, Games, which is the song that Mark Morrison used for Return of the Mac.
Okay.
And what's funny to me is that...
Is it a sample?
Yeah. Okay. And first off, the Chucky Booker music video is insane. Like, it's got so many early 90s music video tropes, like girl standing by window while the curtain blows. Like, it's just got some really great 90s. Yeah, some great. But, like, I would encourage listeners to go back and discover Chucky Booker's Games, because it is a phenomenal song. And it's one of those rare instances where the song that sampled it only like 3 years later.
Oh, wow.
Like, it wasn't that much. Like, it wasn't in the world for like 20 years, like it typically is, like 3 years later. Did Chucky Booker get paid? We're going to have to do some research and find out what happened to my man, Chucky Booker. I'm sure he's still out there singing. Hopefully he makes some money every time we play Return of the Mac.
I hope so. And did you discover the original from the sample?
I'll be honest. I knew, because in Atlanta, Atlanta didn't play a lot of hip hop on the radio in the 90s during the daytime. So we got slow jams, and Chucky Booker's Games was like a big hit on, R&B radio.
Okay.
So when Return of the Mac came out, yeah, most of us knew it was a sample, but like Return of the Mac now is like this famous song that you can play almost anywhere in the world. You know, you lied to me. You know, like you can play that anywhere. Meanwhile, Chucky Booker's, why you wanna play your games on me? Not as famous. So I encourage everybody to find Chucky Booker. I think he has an I instead of a Y at the end of Chucky. Chucky Booker Games. You'll be like, oh snap, I didn't know Return of the Mac was a sample.
That's awesome. I can't wait to check that out.
Hey, I'm not here to tell you what to do with your time. But I think we are ready to get this show started.
Let's get this show started.
Let's do it.
I think we should. Well, today we have a song that holds a special place in my heart. Mm. It is a song by an English synth pop band called New Order, and the song is Blue Monday.
Amazing.
Diallo, have I ever told you my New Order story / my first day of seventh grade story?
No, you haven't. I have to know more.
Yeah. So here's the story. This little kid with curly hair called Blake was at a new school, Marin Country Day School. Shout out to all my peeps in Marin County, California. I was the new kid. I didn't know anybody. And what did I do? I have thought about this moment for decades, ever since it happened. And it has been referred to me by many of my since friends. But knowing nobody, I stood up on a giant rock in the field. I put my hand to my forehead and I started looking around as though I was on a ship looking for land. And that is literally what happened on that first day of seventh grade, because it was funny to me. That was like the moment that I knew I'd be a lifetime narcissist. It was all happening in this only child's head, this entire fantasy that this would be funny, that it would make sense, and that it would give me something to do while all these other kids who knew each other said, hey, welcome back to school. Hey, I like you. I like you. I didn't know anybody. So that was my experience. First day of seventh grade. Oh boy. And it's very therapeutic to say this out loud to the world.
We're here for your therapy.
Oh my goodness. It's cheaper than the real thing. So here I am, I'm in seventh grade, and it's sort of that age where maybe the pop radio starts to become less of what you listen to. I latched on to, when this song came on, I immediately latched on to this sound, which was like nothing I'd heard before. It was fast, it was dancey, but while it was sort of this electronic underpinning, it had this sort of punk rock on top, and it had this singing vocal, which was like not even that good. It sounded like nothing else on the radio. And I want to play some of it for you. Can I start to build
Absolutely.
What that track sounds like? Well, let's listen to the drums. Right out the gate, right out the bat, you have something which is a single instrument, just the kick drum, not even the entire drum set, but it's giving you this like signature. This song is knowable in the first second and a half.
It really is. And, you know, those are some iconic drums. When the 80s were having their real, you know, sort of comeback retro moment in the 2000s, I was a DJ. And I will say, as a DJ, you love those kind of songs that start off with just the drums.
Yes.
Because it really, you know, it helps you find the tempo. And it also, because there's nothing else there to clash with the music of the song going out, it really sounds like you can make that blend and transition really really smooth. Yep. What's funny is that I knew this song when I was a kid too, and just like you, I was like kind of like a weirdo. Like all the kids in my school listened to, you know, R&B. There wasn't really a whole lot of hip hop being played on the radio back then. And I just, you know, like the kids knew that, like, they thought I liked Elvis. I actually liked the Beatles. You know, they're like, oh, you're that kid who liked Elvis. And I was like, no.
To them,
I like
the same
Beatles.
Thing.
Yeah, it was the same thing. And it's funny, like, I didn't know terms like punk. I didn't even really know. To me, like, if you'd ask, you know, me that year when this song came out, I would have thought punk was like that really discordant, doesn't make any. Like I would, and if you told me synth pop, I would have thought you might have a lisp or something. None of these, it was like black music and white music, maybe because I was growing up in Atlanta. But it was like, this was white music, but it was like white music that like I loved, you know what I mean? Like it was just like, and it's funny, you thought the vocals didn't sound, I thought he had a great voice. I like the fact that he sounded like very dispassionate. You know, he's like, how does it feel? Like nobody sings like that on the R&B side of the fence.
That's a fair point,
really.
That he does do that particular moment like that. Just generally speaking though, like Bernard's lyrics and his singing are just so off the cuff and
so good
and irrelevant that they turn out to be like iconic and make the song. It's kind of like the Meg White drumming phenomenon. It's like it wouldn't work with anything else. You wouldn't want like you wouldn't want Chaka Khan on top of that song.
Yeah. You know what's crazy is one of the very first CDs or tapes that I ever bought is a group electronic, which Bernard is in, and Getting Away With It, which is a song that's
Johnny Marr.
You know, I freaking love that song. So that's sort of like singing, that style of singing, long before I knew who Joy Division or any of these other groups were. I just loved it. I thought it was like really cool.
Totally. All of that. And we're going to get deep into the vocals in just a moment. Before we get into that, though, I want to talk a little more about the drums. What's really cool about this song is it's a melting pot of a whole lot of different influences. Mm-hmm. And one in particular that New Order, by the way, have extensively talked about this. I have about five books and seen 12 interviews, and there's literally a whole podcast. So there's no sample snitching going on here. They have talked about how they literally decided to take the drum beat from this song for that intro that you just heard.
That's a cool fucking fact.
That is a cool fucking fact.
I have never heard that song in my entire life.
Donna Summer, Our Love, 1979, wow. Georgia Moroder.
And by the way, that sounds like that's like ready for a remix too. Just
we gotta bring
Our Love
back.
Will Last Forever.
Oh yeah, just that little chunk, right? We gotta put that together.
Is fun. Yeah,
we do have a side project.
We're
winking at each other
with some laptops.
We know exactly what we're doing next. And what's kind of interesting about that is that the Donna Summer original is a live drummer, and the way they got that, because a live drummer with one foot on the pedal can't do that unless you're John Bonham from Led Zeppelin, but that's its own thing. So what they did was they have a delay pedal that makes that go the 16th notes. But what New Order did, these guys were absolute wonderful nerds. They built their own equipment. They would buy the things right off the shelf that were brand new. They had one of the first DMXs, which is the drum machine that came before the 808 that
everyone before knows. Before the rapper.
And before, that's right, before DMX and DMX crew. And they programmed that beat. That's how they got it to do the thing that a drummer, a live drummer, couldn't possibly do. And what's interesting about that is this is a moment where this band, this punk band, this post-punk band, formerly Joy Division, they become New Order when their singer commits suicide.
Yeah.
They decide to completely transform themselves and do the most punk thing imaginable, which is to borrow from non-punk music, borrow from dance music, use drum machines. These things are extremely uncool if you're like a diehard, dyed-in-the-wool punk rocker at this time. So
I think that's actually one of the lasting, ingratiating things about punk is that, you know, they were always willing to throw out the rule book. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, and I feel like whether it's Blondie deciding, you know, they were a punk band, but then one of their first big hits is Heart of Glass, which
right.
is, which disco. Was originally called the disco song.
Right.
Yeah. So like, I feel like it's that ability to throw out the rule book. I mean, like, you know, it's the same way that like DJs were scratching records and that was sort of like, oh, right. we're going to make an instrument out of the turntable. Like is, it seems like the late 70s, early 80s was just a really exciting time to try new technology, try new technique. And, try some things on the techniques. 1200s. Shout out to DJs
connection.
Out there.
Nice
you saw that coming.
Insider info.
Yeah.
Insider joke. We're going to dig a little deeper into the background of the band and their influence a little later. But I got a question for you. Diala, were you a cool kid in seventh grade?
Yeah, I'm afraid I was.
You were?
I was a bit of a jock.
You're afraid you were.
You know, people looked at me whenever a ball was being thrown. Or
you wouldn't have been my friend then.
No, I was a nerd.
Yeah. Oh, you were. You weren't a jock. I fell for it. Hook, line, and sinker.
You don't see this cool jacket that I have on? Like, I was clearly a big nerd who's trying to make up for it in later life.
You could have been a sports guy who got converted. I was a sports guy who got converted. I had baseball cards. But that's not the same thing as a jock. That's not the same thing as a jock.
That doesn't make you a jock.
That does not make me a jock. I really walked right into that, didn't I? They're not the same thing. When you are the card collector, you think you're as cool as the jock, though. It's not quite the same.
That is the nerdiest thing I think I've ever heard. I was a jock because I collected little pieces of paper with pictures of athletes on them. Okay.
We've got to be kind to our 13-year-old selves. It was my protective armor back then, thinking that I was part of this larger world because I had the baseball cards and knew the stats.
I came to the realization real quick. One day while playing basketball in elementary school, even I was just like, I'm not good at this. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna go another direction.
Smart.
I'm gonna stake out this unclaimed territory over here.
Well, that's what I did with music. That's literally that's where this band and this song comes into play, because
yeah, I mean, I would argue that they sound like, I mean, that, you know, to mention the vocals again, he sounds like kind of a nerd, and I think it was like nerds unite.
Right.
Like
right.
You know, we as nerds heard that voice and we were like, I can do that.
Yeah, this isn't like Simon Le Bon or Paul Young.
No,
or
those guys sounded cool.
This guy's not a good singer. He's just a guy singing. There's a distinction. And the guy singing, that's what punk rock
is. I heard it as good singing, but also like very like lecturely, like professorial.
Okay.
Maybe.
So sort of talky.
Talky singing.
Sprechschange. Well, let's pause there for a second. Back up a little bit and get into the band. Because New Order, as many people know, but not everybody... So if you're joining New Order Party a little later, used to be Joy Division. And Joy Division, the band, seminal post-punk band out of Manchester, late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Two albums, and then the lead singer committed suicide.
Well, it was like right before their U.S. tour, right?
Eve of their years ago, they're leaving the next day
on
the U.S.
tour.
And Ian Curtis puts on an Iggy Pop record. And commits and
was watching
himself.
Like Looney Tunes cartoons.
Maybe,
apparently,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
At least according to the film 24 Hour Party People, which if you haven't seen that movie, like, you know, after you finish this show, go watch that movie.
Watching.
It's a great movie with
Steven Coogan. Yeah. I love that guy.
Great movie.
Yeah.
A lot of fun,
Alan
even
Partridge.
If you don't know that music. But I'm sorry, please continue.
No worries. No, I mean,
I want to know more about these nerds.
And in the wake of their singer dying, is they're like, what the hell do we do? And the three of them that were left over gradually put the pieces back together, started writing new songs. There's some really cute early footage where they don't even know who's singing. So all three of them try try singing. There's some live footage when they go to New York, which is going to be important in a moment. They go tour in New York. They're called, they may or may not be called New Order for the first few shows, but they don't even know who the singer is. They're figuring it out.
But okay, so they had some setbacks, obviously. But
the death of their singer being a pretty big
one. That's a pretty big one.
But they regrouped, and not only did they reform, they added the drummer Stephen Morris's girlfriend Jillian on keyboards. They
I didn't know that. Their keyboardist was a girl?
Jillian is Stephen Morris's wife now. They're still together all these years later.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, and they've got tanks in their backyard. They're crazy.
They have tanks?
Yeah, I don't know why. For some reason, the drummer from New Order collects tanks. It's just something he likes.
I'm still worried about them. I see a lot of,
that's true.
A lot of militaristic stuff
right.
going on.
I mean,
on.
These guys are growing up in post-war like England. There's bombed out areas. I mean, this is like different from like in America. We didn't have bombs like in that building next mm-hmm. to us kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. They all grew up in the shadow of the war in a much more direct way. Mm. Also the era, these guys are a little older than us, but yeah. You're right, their war obsession is really interesting to think about. It's clearly a big part of this band.
I gotta say one thing is I didn't know what they look like. Like, we've talked a lot about how the vocals right. made us think that they were like, you know, kindred spirit nerds with us,
right.
but I don't think I knew
they
at all what
their
the
faces
band looked
on
like.
Album covers.
Like, who were they? Was the whole no pictures thing intentional?
Absolutely. It was the contrarianism goes all the way down to their record label Factory, which is that movie 24 Hour Party
Heck
People's
yeah.
about Tony Wilson. Their entire shtick, if you will, mm-hmm. was let's just do it differently. Do it the way we want to. A big fuck you, by the way, to London, because they're in Manchester, so it's like a smaller town. So like the music industry, it's very centered in London.
I think mystery with like pop artists is so cool. Like,
me too.
I didn't, you know, like Chic went out of their way
yeah.
to not have their faces at first on like albums, and Roxy Music did that, and Daft Punk did that.
Right.
You know, like we didn't know what Daft Punk looked like. Ghostface Killah, when he first came out, the reason he was called Ghostface Killah in the Wu-Tang was because he was the one Wu-Tang member who always had a mask on in every video. Like,
mystery
I feel
is
like,
cool. We need more mystery.
Man, like,
yeah.
I don't need to know. Who are you, Charlie Puth? I don't need to know.
It makes it kind of more special. Yeah, and these guys didn't put their faces
on
album
covers. Don't be mad.
Oh, yeah, we love you, Charlie Puth.
We love you, Charlie Puth.
You know, maybe try a mask every now and then just to mix it up if you'd like. But not because you're ugly. You're pretty.
Dead
pretty
mouse,
guy.
He might be.
He's a handsome
who
man.
Who knows? Oh, he's handsome?
I think so.
See, that makes me angry then.
Oh, I don't
show
know.
Your face, Dead Mouse.
So we've talked about the mystery element of the band. One other thing I need to point out is we think a lot about between the two of us as disco fans, the whole disco demolition moment, mm-hmm. 1979, disco sucks, disco ends. Disco doesn't really end, as we all know. Disco just goes underground. And what a really important thing happens when New Order plays in New York at that show I'm just referring to, they go out and they party and they go to all these New York nightclubs and they are exposed to disco music. And it's not just the disco music. There's many forms of disco music. There's sort of the Latin tinge. There's the black tinge. There's the gay tinge. They're going to gay nightclubs where the BPMs are crazy because Blue Monday is 130 BPM and Sylvester
really
is 130 BPM.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Yeah. And from my understanding of dance music history, there is a BPM distinction happening in a lot of these clubs, especially in the late 70s. So they're going.
That makes
sense. They're getting these fast BPMs. You know, everyone's popping whatever. Amyl. I don't even know. And they're going crazy at 130. And they bring this home with them. They bring this idea home with them. They're like, we want to make a fast dance record inspired by their experiences in New York. So not only did they bring the BPMs back, they brought some of the Sylvester synth bass back, and I'm going to play a little bit of that for you right now. So what we just heard was a programmed 16th note bass pattern. Like, a human can't play that so perfectly. Mm. And it's not happening on a bass guitar. It's happening on the Moog synth.
Got it.
And it is evoking very, very closely this.
I mean, first off, everybody borrows and takes and is
Absolutely.
Inspired by stuff. So I don't, but that, I've never heard that relation before. And now
so
I'm
directly,
like,
right.
Oh, you could almost sing Blue Monday over.
You totally could.
The Sylvester.
And not only is that connection there, the Sylvester connection, but there's another track with a very similar sound on the bass on the synth bass, as well as the structure of the sound. And that's the song that at the time, New Order was also going to their own club, the Hacienda, which had just opened in Manchester.
Very important club.
And this is one of the biggest hits at that club at the time. Do you know that track?
I know it.
Classic,
but what is
Italo
it?
Track by Klein and MBO called Dirty Talk.
Dirty Talk.
Right, right.
There's something I love. Can I tell you one of the things I love the most? I mean, like, clearly this is like the stuff that you and I like, really like. And liked. But what is that clap? Like, what is that? That's not like a snare. Is that just like a hand clap?
So a lot of times to get that in the early days, they would literally program white noise on a synthesizer and you could just hit a note that had been, the filters and knobs had been manipulated in such a way that instead of getting a pitch, you would just get a ka, ka, and Moroder does that too.
Moroder does that too. Yeah. Like that hand clap,
yeah.
No pun intended, slaps.
It's a slappy clap.
It's a slappy clap.
Slappy clap. So Dial, you asked me a moment ago about bass guitar, because what we just heard, that synth part isn't played on bass guitar. And as you know, Hookie from Joy Division and New Order is a bass player, you know, famous for his very melodic bass parts. And
I didn't know his nickname was Hookie. Apparently.
His name is Hookie. Peter Hook.
Yeah.
Peter Hookie Hook.
Peter Hook. I never heard Hookie.
Perfect. Because he came up for the hook in the song, which he's playing on top of the bass line. He's a bass player, not playing a bass line, but actually a melodic part. And here it is. And just to get a little nerdy for a second,
wow,
that bass line, it's very EQ'd, so there's a lot, there's like a low, a high pass filter, so you don't hear a lot of low end, so it can be on top of the bass line. And there's also parts later in the song where there's another bass part that's kind of used as a solo. So there are parts of the song where we've got three bass things happening at once, which is insane, but somehow works.
Can I just say, the whole jangly guitar with like tons of echo on it, almost never fails.
You love it every time. And if you like that, you might like Where It Came From.
It came from somewhere?
Oh, yes, it did, my friend.
What is that Sergio Leone?
Yep, that's a soundtrack to a Sergio Leone movie called Fistful of Dollars.
Fistful of Dollars,
and that is that's an Ennio Morricone track.
Yeah, Morricone.
Yep. That's A Few Dollars More from the trilogy, though.
It's part of the trilogy. Right. What's crazy about that is the second you started playing the Spaghetti Western song, I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah,
and I was like, there's a New Order call back in here. Like, you know, that's insane. And by the way, that was only the Spaghetti Westerns given when they came out. That's only like 10 years old.
You're right.
It would have been about the time that they're using it. It's like if I, it's like if you and I took something from
the
like
2000s,
Superman versus Batman. No, it's not even that long ago. It's like 10 years ago. That's
Hookie
crazy.
Was just happened to be watching. He tells the story.
I will not call him Hookie. I don't have that relationship with Peter Hook.
It's Hookie. It's Barney. It's Steve and it's Jillian.
Oh boy, Bernard goes by Barney?
He goes by Barney. He looks, this is a radio show, but the disappointed look on Diallo's face.
Never meet your heroes. Never meet Diallo your heroes. If I had known they were Barney and Hookie, I would have turned this radio station off.
Okay. The British do that and they call sandwiches like Sammy's. They're so silly. They're so silly, those Brits.
So Blue Monday spent 38 weeks in the top 75 and has been dubbed a synth pop classic.
Wow. When you said the top 75, it really blew my mind.
Some of those weeks, it was at number one.
Okay.
It wasn't like sitting at 74 for
But you really got
weeks.
To spread it out across the two-thirds of an annum.
Yes. And by the way, global hit.
Mm.
You know, like you said, number one 12-inch of all time.
Maybe we should talk about that. It is the number one 12-inch single of all time to this day, which is kind of crazy.
That is
especially
wild.
Because there's a factoid that I've seen reported 30 different ways where they actually lost money on every copy because they printed it as a die cut. It looks like a floppy disk.
Like it doesn't, it looks like a floppy disk.
It looks like a floppy disk, and they had like a special machine to cut out holes in the cardboard, so they lost money.
It's a piece of art. It's a piece of art. And yet it somehow it always ends up in the dollar bins when you find that one record store in your town that hasn't been gone out of business.
Exactly. Exactly. We're going to get into more about this song's production a little later in the show. Plus, I'm going to talk about how this song not only influenced me as a music fan, but as a music maker. All that coming up after the break. Stay tuned.
Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Saving money on everything for your projects. Now at Menards. We have it all for garden and landscaping essentials. Visit our outdoor garden center today and update your backyard space. Grid accents lattice panels have a timeless design with an innovative design that's simple to install and requires almost no maintenance. Save big on lattice panel options at Menards. View our entire selection of garden center products today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to One Song. Before the break, we pulled apart the bass guitar and synth from New Order's Blue Monday to examine the band's revolutionary sound. Let's go even further into the mix.
Let's do that.
Do a deep dive.
Right.
You know, let's go even further into the mix.
Already talked about how these guys pioneered bringing dance beats into post-punk music and pop music, frankly, because this track hit the pop charts. It was, as we saw, 75 in the top 75 for 38 weeks. But the people were buying this and people were dancing to it big time. And it was a revolution in certain quarters that didn't necessarily have 130 BPM dance tracks before this. One thing they were also a pioneer in is they were early to the sampling game.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that they sampled at all.
There is a sample in this song. They had just gotten a very early prototype, an early example of an emulator, like a very early sampling device. I don't even know how many seconds of sampling time. It was probably like 2 seconds and maybe 8-bit, very low resolution. But they used it on this track, and I'm going to show you the part they used.
Okay.
I'm going to play that in the mix for you, just in case you know that one. You know what that is?
I was going to say you were playing some of the parts earlier that I was waiting for you to tell me that the keyboardist actually was playing that.
Okay. She is.
So that, so.
But what about the choir?
Oh, yeah. That's not.
No. Them. And as soon as I play the source, she'll be like, oh, yeah, I got that. And here it is. Do you recognize that? That's Kraftwerk, my friend. That is Uranium by Kraftwerk. And they were one of the first.
I love that Kraftwerk was making songs. I mean, like, granted, some of those Kraftwerk songs completely work in the clubs, but some of those weirder Kraftwerk songs, like who listening to that drone song was like, oh, this is definitely going to rock the
party.
I
love this drone.
This is hell yeah. Like, we're not finished, guys. We need that drone. We need some of that drone sound.
Yeah, that's from their album Radioactivity from 1975. Amazing. And they grabbed a copy of that, threw it in their sampler, and just in the spirit of experimentation, threw it in the mix. Now, of course, it is an important part of the song to this day, but it's something that you may not have noticed otherwise.
Oh, I think we should actually hear a little bit of its use in the song, in the mix. Here we go, in the mix.
Oh, by the way, you just singing that made me think, what we're a little bit of a foreshadowing when we get to the actual vocal stems and talk about the mm-hmm. lyrics, but what did you just sing? You Make Me Feel. Yeah. How does it feel?
Oh my gosh.
Okay, revelations are happening on mic.
Get Hooky on the phone.
Get Hooky on the phone. Get Barney. Barney.
Get Hooky and Barney on the horn.
Barney, I need a Sammy.
I feel like a cigar chopping like producer. Hey, I need Hooky and Barney. Get him on the horn.
Get him on the horn.
All right. That's I mean, this is insane.
It's crazy. It's insane. It's crazy town, USA.
This is like, you know, when you're standing at one of those paintings and like it's a whole bunch of different pictures, but then when you take a step back, it looks like Barack Obama's face. Like, this is incredible to see all these parties come together.
That is a great analogy. Oh, that's awesome.
That's right.
Absolutely true.
And I'm getting chills hearing all this stuff come together, though.
Right. You know, what's really ironic about this song is all of the effort, all of these new toys and new technologies.
All these parts.
I haven't even gotten to the part where they like programmed something. It took them all night long and then it was wrong and then they kept it. There's a lot going on that's insane. The irony of it, though, is they intended for this song to save them labor because they despise doing encores. When they were playing in New York, I was just mentioning before, yeah. they would do 27-minute shows and then leave the stage and it would cause a riot. And it got to the point where their manager was like, could you guys like come up with one more song, please?
Wait, why was it causing a riot when they would...
Because people paid money to see them and they leave and after they less than half an hour. They wouldn't even do the encore. The encore is like this, you know, whatever. The history of encores is, oh, it's a surprise, they're coming back. But of course, it's the expected thing. Yeah. And that voice is a character I'm working on called Lamar.
Lamar's going to get his own spinoff. So their idea was like they would just push a button and sort of play this song, and that way they wouldn't have to put in a solid 30 minutes.
1,000% right.
To play for
this
30
was
minutes.
A yet another up yours to the man that they would have a song that would be a push button and walk off the stage kind of situation. And then it turned out to be this track that they were like, wait, this is actually really good. I think we have a hit on our hands. And then it turns out to be the number
That's
one.
Always the way.
It's always the
That's
way.
Always the way. Blur, you know, is like,
it's
Blur
the
is
throwaway.
Disappointing. With their reception in the United States, mm-hmm. and they're like, everything over there is grunge, and so they make a little 2-minute song called Song 2 to make fun of American grunge, and then of course that becomes the biggest Blur song of all time.
That's always how it is. You're absolutely right. Well,
you got to be comfortable and kind of relaxed and not taking it too seriously, I think, sometimes in art to really stumble upon what you're capable of.
Well, this effortless throwaway backfired on them big time because they put all this time and effort into it, and they created a monster hit.
Monster hit.
So we've been teasing the iconic vocal from this track this whole episode. So we're finally going to play it for you. These are the isolated vocals from Blue Monday by New Order.
How does it feel to treat me like you do when you've laid your hands upon me and told me who you are? Thought I was mistaken. I thought I'd heard your words. Tell me, how do I feel? Tell me now, how do I feel?
Wow, I didn't know that we were using autotune back then.
That's a vocoder, and they had originally wanted for the whole thing to be that robot voice thing.
Yeah.
And then they just couldn't quite get it to where they were happy with it. So they mixed it in, and that's why it's got that kind of cool blend.
Well, I was going to say, it's weird to hear the isolated vocals because... it actually sounds higher in register than I'm used to hearing it in my ears in the mix. Does that make sense? And in the mix, it sounds like a deeper voice. It sounds like, how
does it feel to treat me like you do?
I think you're right. That's an interesting thing you noticed, where the context of the music kind of creates an environment where the vocal, because everything else is so hard and boom, ding, boom, like it's so intense, that his vocal kind of benefits from that. But on its own, it's a little
on its own, it feels a little bit higher. And I know it's not auto-tune, it's a vocoder, but it's like there's more going on with that vocal. It's not like just a clean vocal. Like there's doubling going on and
imperfection.
There's imperfection. Yeah. And I kind of like it when it goes extra robot-y at the very end of
that. Me too. That part's great.
There's like texture.
There's kind of like a phasey thing on it, which I hadn't really noticed before, like a phase filter on top of it, which is very like when you hear it isolated, that literally could be an acapella in a Daft Punk song. Like that is,
I was just thinking that.
Right? Doesn't that feel like something that Daft Punk would use? It's usually those same characteristics. It could be like a Stardust Music Sounds Better With You is how they treat the vocals with the same things. It's a real vocal, it's a vocoder, and some phasing. They have the same, you know, checklist.
You gotta have all three. you mentioned earlier that there's like some wonkiness, timing that may be off in the song.
Yeah, it's so funny whenever I think about like how they put the song together, because it really brought out another side of these guys. Like they got really nerdy. They would go home and they would learn these manuals. By the way, these are early proto, you know, these machines are hard to operate.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just like sat down and looked at these 500 page manuals and learned how to use Oberheim DMX drum machines and and learn how to sequence. That's another thing where they would use the drum machine pattern to sequence the synth. That is like a revolutionary concept. They're in the middle of Manchester. There's no internet. There's no YouTube.
Yeah.
They're figuring this stuff out for themselves. And one thing that happened a few times is they would program something and then it would get destroyed or it would get lost or it would be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this one part of the song where there's a sequence that's wrong. But when they heard it in the mix, they were like, that's kind of cool. Let's leave it in. So I'll play that for you now.
Let's hear that.
I'll play it for you now isolated. And then you'll be like, oh, that sounds all right. But in the mix, it's like, what is happening?
Sounds weird, but okay.
It sounds weird.
Crazy. Doesn't sound crazy.
That sounds like it didn't quite come in at the right time, uh-huh. Right? Well, here it is in the mix.
What's funny is that keyboard that goes, that's clearly well lined up with his vocal. The other part sounds almost like a half idea that they were like, well, we'll just bury this a little bit down in the mix.
Well, it would sound right on with the rest of the sequencing, because it's this little, it's a pattern that if it was like lined up correctly, would just feel normal. Yeah. And it would align with what the bass line is doing and where the chords are going. But it's off by like a 16th note or something.
You can hear it, yeah.
And it's like they probably could have like taken 5 hours to reprogram everything to get it right. But they're just like, actually, this is kind of cool. Let's leave it in.
Because it's not like nowadays where like it's a lot easier to change things now.
Exactly.
Versus back then.
Right now, we could look at the screen in Ableton and like nudge, the segment and move it over here at the end. But back then, you had to like start from zero.
Start from scratch. They're like, just leave it in.
It's like, this is bar 58. And like, there's so much going on to like get the exactitude of what you're sequencing and programming. And there's no YouTube to help you. And, you know,
of course. And by the way, sometimes when things are wrong, like, you know, I feel like your brain kind of fixes them a little bit, or just thinks, oh, that's where that's supposed to go.
Right.
I feel like, you know, hip hop producers like Dilla and Timbaland have always made use of the idea of things not landing exactly where you expect them.
Right.
So that it sounds new and there's like some tension there.
Right. And it sounds new is a big part of it too. It's like, I haven't heard this before.
Exactly.
Let's see if we can't make it work and add to the vocabulary. So a little earlier, we were talking about how this song made a big impression on me as a baby luxury in seventh grade. But as we've been talking about it, and as I've been listening back to the stems, it's still so fresh, first of all. I've been hearing this song for 40 years,
mm-hmm.
but it's reminding me of another seminal moment in my life when I started actually making music, when I started becoming a songwriter myself. What's funny is that when I started making songs, you would never recognize luxury at the beginning. Those first demo tapes or whatever, what I was making, it was all this like riff rock stoner stuff. It was like Caius, you know who Caius are? They're this stoner rock band who later became Queens of the Stone Age.
Oh,
the lead singer did, Josh Homme.
Okay.
It was his first entity. And it was just a slow, sludgy Black Sabbath stoner rock, really slow tempos, like tuning down to C, so everything's like rumble. And that, I love that. And that's what I was making. And I was talking to my friend Summer, shout out to Summer Burks. She gave me a couple of like, she listened to my stuff. She's like, I think what it needs, she was basically suggesting that I kind of lighten the mood a little bit and be more like me, who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking and it eventually clicked that I wanted to try using some machines. I started thinking about New Order and the stuff that I really genuinely loved from a little earlier in my life.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget the time I went to rehearsal space back when I was like, had my first songs and I was looking for a band. And I would just bring a guitar and like a drum machine. And I remember being in the room playing the drum machine coming out through the giant PA monitors and playing guitar and singing and being like, this is so satisfying. The sound of machine and man. And it's like, I'm imperfect. My guitar playing is not that great. My songs are a bit like, you know, I'm a new songwriter. There's nothing polished about this at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is raw. This is rough. But underneath it, there is a steady tempo that is locking everything in and kind of making it fun, making it danceable. And that was really the origin, I should say, the New Order that I was hearing come through the speakers that was my music, but I could hear where it came from. I could hear the New Order being a huge, like 90% of the sound I was going for.
Can I just weigh in on that and say that I think dance music is in some ways very pure. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the popularity of rock and roll taking off, like people used to play rock at sock hops so that people could dance, mm-hmm. you know? And for most of its history, hip hop was, you know, dance music. It didn't mean that like that was the first goal of it, but you could usually move right. to hip hop. I think that's one of the reasons why sometimes when I hear some of the more, let's just say emo hip hop of right now, I'm like, damn, how could you ever dance to this? Like, I kind of want to get back to the groove. And even when you said earlier today, that disco sort of ended after Comiskey Park, I think it ended as like a genre that record labels were into, right. but look at Off the Wall.
Oh yeah.
And Thriller, like
those are disco records.
I feel like black audiences never gave up on disco. Disco just sort of moved into the 80s.
That's right.
Because Off the Wall is a disco record.
Hip-hop.
Like it's
hip-hop,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. And hip hop, like, you know, Sugar Hill Gang, that was disco. So in some ways disco didn't go away. It just continued to evolve. And right. I think that what you're saying is very true. Bands like New Order. And again, I was the only black kid at my all black school in elementary school, listening to New Order and Pet Shop Boys and Human League and all these different groups. But I think the reason why I was into them more than the American rock bands was because the British understood, yeah, like people want to dance. People want that groove,
right.
you know? And
right.
I think all these British groups, they didn't forsake the groove.
No, the danciness is at the core of all that
yeah.
stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
It's not guitar driven. It's still drum driven music.
Right. And of course, you know, fine. We can go back in time and find some rock bands that have some danciness to them. But essentially, you know, there is a bodiness to the live element of rock music, but it's kind of aggressive and it's like slam dancing. And, you know, it is a cathartic thing, but it's not like rhythmic and like, you know, sexy. It's
yeah.
definitely not sexy.
I think that the same way that a lot of live drummers were coming to drum machines, mm-hmm. You know, they were like, oh, I got to stand out. I got to be Keith Moon,
mm-hmm.
you know, but there was something about that drum machine. And I grew up in the South where we had like, you know, we had Miami Bass and we had, you know, Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa, which also samples Kraftwerk.
Yes, it does.
All that stuff.
Interpolates.
The dance. Yeah, the dance was very important.
I'm so
that.
Sorry. I had to give you an interpolation.
No.
There.
Listen, you, we don't
brand.
Actually get paid unless you whisper.
It's my brand.
I get it.
Well, Diallo, I am so glad we got to talk about New Order today, because it's
me
just
too.
My personal connection to the band, to this song, is so deep in ways that I didn't even realize until we were halfway through this talking about it just now. Like the epiphanies were happening live on air.
So, I was learning live on air. I didn't know half as much that I thought I knew about this song.
And I loved hearing about your experiences with the band and the song too. I think all in all, this may be the greatest episode ever taped of a podcast or radio show ever made.
Well, it's definitely going to be in the top 75.
It's in one of the 38 in the top 75. So that was Blue Monday by New Order.
Now it's time for a segment that we call DJ Challenge. Luxury and I will each come up with five songs for a secret scenario.
Ooh, secret.
We each selected before the show.
I love this game. And by the way, I am a DJ.
I am also sometimes a DJ.
Okay. I'm going to go first. I am, by the way, seeing this for the first time. So the secret scenario you selected for me, this is news
yeah.
to me.
We just don't even know.
I don't even know.
Here's the DJ challenge. You
All
get
right.
a phone call. You have to DJ a party for, okay, it's 2005. You have to DJ a party for Prince.
Oh my God. Are you insane? I would slam the phone down and cry and run to the next city.
They're gonna sweeten the deal.
Just to be clear, Prince is one of my most idols of all time.
Yeah.
And my worship for him is terrifying me. That's what's happening here. Because how am I gonna please Prince?
I mean, like
notoriously unpleasable.
He famously will walk out of the party if a DJ plays a Prince
and
song.
I can picture this because I've been to Paisley Park, so I can picture the room where this would be happening. I can picture that's the setup in the area away from where the costumes well currently are. I don't think they would have been there when he was alive, but now there's all the costumes from the other eras.
No,
but here's what I play.
You have to play something.
I'm gonna play oh, I know exactly what it is.
Okay, what are you gonna play?
I'm gonna play Joni Mitchell. Because
Joni Mitchell.
Prince is a huge
Which
Joni
song?
Mitchell fan.
You're gonna play album cuts, I assume.
I'm gonna play.
Because that's the only thing hard about Prince. He's not like somebody who's just casually into music. Like he knows.
Oh yeah.
He knows music.
He's deep. He's
you
deep.
Know.
I'm gonna play, or maybe I could play Mavis Staples because I just learned that he was obsessed.
I think
with
that's
that.
A safe bet.
Yeah.
I think if it was me, I'd probably go like, you know, early 70s funk.
Yeah.
I think.
But see, that's why I was so excited when I had the Joni Mitchell moment, because I was like, oh, that would be not expected. Uh-huh. But it's also not danceable, and it would clear the dance floor and he'd be irritated. What if I could be risky.
Yeah.
I could be risky and play one of my favorite mixes of his own songs. I do love the long version of Pop Life.
Mm.
From Around the World in a Day.
I do too.
That bass line.
I will say, DJ Rashida, who's out here in LA, she did a lot of the parties for Prince, like at his house or like whenever he had a party out in a club. And
there are no Prince rule.
She tended to do, she was the person who told a friend of mine, I think she might have told me too, but she definitely told a friend of mine, you can't play Prince.
Then I'm going to go with Funkadelic. Shit, goddamn, get off your ass and jam.
I think that's the way to go. He's also a big Sly fan.
Shit, goddamn.
Get off your ass and jam. Shit, goddamn.
Get off your ass and jam. That's the one I'm doing.
That's the one. That's a great answer.
Thank you.
Give me one. Give me a DJ challenge, my friend.
You know what? I just thought of a great one. Here we go. The year is 2012.
Oh, okay.
And there's a special event happening, and it's called the inauguration.
Second inauguration of Obama.
Barack Obama.
Okay.
What you doing? So we've had 4 years already to get used to it.
That's like a nightmare scenario for me, because, you know, when you DJ a party for politicians in general, I think I did one for Villaraigosa.
We're in D.C. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was going to say I did one for L.A. Mayor Villaraigosa. I think I did one for Eric Garcetti when he was running. Don't hold any of those guys against me. I need the money. Daddy had to spin some records and get some cash for his kids. You know, it's always tough because on the one hand, you have a lot of, it's almost the opposite of Prince. You have people who basically are not music experts.
Right.
All they want is the result of everybody dancing.
Yeah.
So you get that a lot. You're like, oh God, it's the worst thing you can hear as a DJ. It's like, play something upbeat. Like, they don't know what upbeat means.
Right.
They just know that means people get up and start dancing. So, but also you can't embarrass them. Like, if I'm doing Obama's party, like, I can't be playing like NWA. You could literally bring down a person's career and thereby, you know, the country by your song selection. I just think it's high stakes. So if I'm playing Obama's party, I'd probably put 2012 was Gautier someone I used to know. Was that out yet?
Yeah, that might have been.
I'd probably play that. You might be able to get away with Crazy by Gnarls Barkley. Like, it's almost like you have to play
songs
that people assume the cool kids are into, even though we know the cool kids are like, you know, once you're in the top 75 for 38 weeks, the cool kids have moved on to something else.
Game changes.
But yeah, I would probably play a selection of safe bets.
Would you play? No, you go first.
No, I was going to say, like, I know that Questlove has done parties for the Obamas and, you know, some other friends. I think DJ Adam 12 played some. I'll tell you what's a safe bet. You can always play stuff like Stevie Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you can definitely play like the safest, coolest version of like a wedding set, because that's never going to really have anything offensive. It's one of those examples where you kind of don't want to make the news. Now, let's say it wasn't the Obamas. Let's say it's like some attention star people. Let's say it's like the cast of Vanderpump Rules. Like, if that's the case, then I'm absolutely first off, James Kennedy from that show is a DJ. He proudly says, I open for Cascade. So, you know, shout out to all the people who watch Vanderpump Rules. It's a guilty pleasure of mine. And I feel like with that crew, I would probably be willing to play 21 Savage, Drake, and everything else that's popular on the radio. So there you go. That's sort of the balance. For the Obamas, you got to go safe. For other people, it's like, make the news.
Would you play Blue Monday? Could Blue Monday make the
cut?
Actually,
you could probably play Blue Monday for Obama or the Vanderpump. Right?
It kind of works in both, doesn't it? That's magic.
You could probably do both.
And Cole and the Gang Celebration would work in both.
My man, Luxury, do you have any final words for seventh grade
life? Oh, hang in there, buddy. It gets so much better. But also hold on to this anecdote because it'll be funny in 40 years.
40 years?
That's a little more than it was.
Yeah.
Let's be generous. It'll be funny.
No, you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe you need a few more years, and then
exactly. I'm not quite healed, as this show demonstrates. This semi-therapeutic show. It's been great.
But in season
though.
Two of this show, you're gonna be like, I'm
finally over it.
I'm golden. I'm gonna say, how do you feel? And your reply will be
mighty real.
Oh, there you go. Luxury, help me in this thing.
All right. Well, coming from me, Luxury, DJ, songwriter, and interpolation whisperer.
And me, Diallo Riddle, actor, director, writer, and sometimes DJ.
This has been
One Song.
One Song is a SiriusXM and Kevin Hart's LOL Radio production. It's hosted by me, Luxury, and my friend Diallo Riddle. This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson and Jordan Colling, with engineering from Marcus Hom. Additional production support from Leslie Guam, Charles Childers, and Alicia Shimada. This show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, and Eric Weil.
Hey, I'm Paul Scheer.
I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jason Manzoukas.
And we're the hosts of How Did This Get Made?, a comedy podcast where we deconstruct, make fun of, and celebrate the best, worst movies ever made.
Have you ever seen a movie that's so bad that it's actually good? That's what we're talking about.
From blockbuster franchises and made-for-TV romances
to bonkers 80s action flicks and obscure sci-fi musicals, we cover it all.
You can find How Did This Get Made? Wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode, idiot.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.